some being that we suspect to be able to begin things, and we want to find out about him, about men, about ourselves. If we do that, we get not enough witnesses. Whom can we ask? If you really want to begin with a beginner, then that is valid subjectively too. The first witness, the first beginner are we ourselves as we sit here. We are the first witnesses. That is what the first hour of the course is for. The first hour of the course is there in order that everybody of you might try to tell not only why he came to this course, but if possible, why he is troubled, namely troubled about the world. What made him to be troubled? What the questions are out of his personal experience, and I do not mean subjective and individual experience, that means the troubles of our mental state, if we are mentally instable, unstable or not, does not interest me in the least. Because emotionally unstable we all are, and I hope we all will be still we die, because if we don't, we would be cold fish. But what interests here is the question, what are your personal experiences with this our situation? What have you thought about it? What lines of inquiry have you tried? And what makes you so troubled? Those things we want to find out in the first hour of the course, to discuss with each other, to make them as far as we can more and more relevant. Because using or renewing the Socratic method, not as it is believed to be, because that is the Platonic method and by no means the Socratic method. I mean the forgotten Socratic method, which consists in one very daring assumption. And one wonderful assumption. Maybe that Socrates really meant to say to everybody, you are as much a philosopher as I am. You just don't know it. You have not become enough aware of it. Let me add to this line, my own line. I would say, perhaps you are aware of it. There is no human being that can make any valuable move in his life without philosophizing. So we want to engage in a practice, a practice of philosophizing. We want to interchange our experiences, which we made by philosophizing, consciously or unconsciously or whatever, already. We want to evaluate those experiences and find out their relevance to the situations and the specific life and death problems of our time and our situation. So the first witnesses are we ourselves, and the main ones. That is what the first hour is for. Not to make us philosophers, whatever that might be, but to make us what we are. The Delphian Oracle also said, become what you are. And we suppose here, this is an assumption that we are or might be free, which would mean that we are philosophic men, all of us. And we try to become, in that sense, what we are, only to become it fuller and better, namely philosophic men who look into things for themselves and know more and more how to do it. For that, we also take philosophers into our inquiry sometimes, people who can show us how they did it. It's also useful to take courses in philosophy for that purpose. But we do not teach philosophy here, because philosophy cannot be taught. It can only be taught as a science of ideas, as a history of ideas, namely what other men have thought. That's very interesting and very useful, but it doesn't help us in the least for our inquiry. It only supports us, as science can support us, as art can support us. We are trying to philosophize. We are interested in an activity. We suspect that this activity is a creative activity of men, of free men, and that it might be a central creative activity. Perhaps we can find that all other creative activities of men are somehow related to this activity, and that men, without being philosophic, is not creative at all. This inquiry demands ourselves as the first participants in our full birthright as philosophic men. What else can come to our help? There are a few men who had already fallen out of the metaphysical predicament, namely philosophers, or let's say thinking men, philosophic men. Let's not even call them philosophers, because they didn't want or couldn't be. We are unable to be metaphysicians anymore. Odd men, so to speak, who first realized that they didn't have the right anymore to move on general assumptions, and therefore are suspected to be slightly nihilistic. People who first suffered the trouble of our time and really exposed themselves to it, and did not only think, but either thought in a way that it amounted to deeds, and they became outcasts and lost their life, or at least their social standing by it immediately. Or people who even did certain things by which they made themselves as unpopular. The father of them is Immanuel Kant, whom in a way we can excuse because he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't intend to do what he did, namely really to destroy the belief in metaphysical assumptions and to make metaphysics impossible for modern men. But he did it bravely, in spite of his longings for quite different things, and so we might sometimes call him in to ask him questions about our problems. But then certainly some people who suffered the full breakdown of what we call the nihilistic situation on themselves, on their first Friedrich Nietzsche, their own Kierkegaard, and of the younger ones, thinkers like Camus, like Heidegger, people who in a way, and we will prove that, exposed themselves to this new predicament of absolute uncertainty, and confessed to be absolutely uncertain, forerunners of the real philosophic men who Socrates was, who were brave enough first to say, I know that I do not know. That means, I confess that I do not know about general assumptions. I will not come before you and try to tell you what being is and draw my conclusions from it. I will not come before you and tell you that I received some higher messages about what men should do, because I didn't receive them. I come before you as a man who knows that he does not know more than you. That means essentially more, that he has no superior knowledge, no higher knowledge, that he can have only the knowledge you have and can have, and without any assumptions. We might, in our inquiry, we are entitled, I think, to trust persons like that to a certain degree, in order to listen to their experiences and what they have to say about us and our situation. And there's fortunately a third set. And those are, I will not call them philosophers either, because at that time one didn't know what philosophy is, and it hadn't been established as a discipline yet. They were thinkers who were in a way in a situation like ours, namely in a situation of the breakdown of one decisive state of the development of mankind, namely the mythical state. When myth broke down and the mythical world didn't hold together anymore, as today the metaphysical world doesn't hold together anymore, then great critics of myth, the first truly independent human thinkers, emerged. They are the nine thinkers, and I take them only as thinkers into account here, I indicated in the program. From Lao Tse to Jesus of Nazareth. They have all one thing in common. They worked and thought at a time when the distinction, which is a metaphysical distinction, the distinction between body and spirit had not yet been made. We are in a situation where the distinction between body and spirit has become very doubtful to us. They worked in a situation where this distinction had not yet been made. That gives us their experience a certain similarity to our experiences, a certain similarity. They also did not claim, nobody of them, that he had higher knowledge. They just started with the question, what can man do? What is he really like? Or, the formula is more philosophical, who is man, not what is man? Who am I? Or is man such a being, really, to which we can, and only to it, apply the question, who is that, not what is that? And is he entitled to ask for himself by the question, who is he? What gives him that right? What are the qualities that entitle him to ask that way? Or is that an illusion of his already? Is that merely an act of power to distinguish himself from everything else? He gives himself the honor. If he asks for himself, he asks who and not what. Because the answers that metaphysics have given in our time finally are that we are not entitled to ask who, but what. What function are we in society? What kind of an organism or a mechanism or a functionality are we? Not who are we, who asks us who we are? According to those theories. But they ask, who is man? Who am I? What is a person? So they are very near to us, and it is no accident. It is symptomatic that modern philosophers, in their despair, have since 15 years, 20, 30 years now, tried again and again to concern themselves with the so-called pre-Platonic philosophers. We concern ourselves also with the pre-Platonic philosophers, but not with the pre-Platonic philosophers of Greece, but with pre-Platonic thinkers. That means with pre-Platonic men, and that means with pre-metaphysical men and post-mythical men. Men who were neither mythical nor metaphysical, but in a unique situation where they had the possibility to look at things as if they looked at them first, as if they were absolutely new. Their experience is fundamental experience. Their findings might be of great relevance to our problems, at least we hope. Those are the three categories of people we are going to ask questions here. You or we. The victims, the modern victims of the breakdown of our assured world, philosophers who went mad or broke down because they didn't want to accept any kind of belief that was offered them in order to at least give them an injection to feel better, but wanted to die absolutely conscious of the situation in which they thought they were. And the third group, those thinkers of the age, so to speak, between the mythical age and the metaphysical age, which is breaking down now. Those are the reasons why we use this unusual method, the method of asking what can we do, why we try to find out about ourselves first, and why we take those three groups of persons permanently into account in our inquiry. Those were the preliminary remarks, and in a way, the lecture of this class. We will add some things later, and then come to normal procedure, which will be that we open, if you have the third hour at 5:20, of course, as Michelangelo painted them on the Sixtina, in the Sixtina Chapella. That's how they must have looked. They are the equals of those pre-Platonic philosophers, not Socrates, the so-called philosophers, the natural philosophers, absolute titans, people of a tremendous power of will, intellect, and intellect. And they helped the Jewish people over that dreadful period by sheer willpower and by a belief that showed to men what now the highest form of belief can mean and how it can help men
in utter destruction, in catastrophe after catastrophe, bowing down before the all-powerful God, taking everything, ready to take the destruction of Jerusalem, ready to take the destruction almost of the whole people, still hoping, still believing. A tremendous psychological, intellectual, and willpower of men has been embodied in those figures of the prophets. Again, great leaders, great geniuses, but again, holy people, people taken apart from all other humanity, people who have been leaders, needed leaders, but leaders, and who could work only with absolute authority and did so. They are terrible figures if free men look at them, but astonishing figures. They show how great men can become by the belief in higher power, or rather how big. Because real greatness is only what those figures we were talking about embody. Great is only what the other fellow can also do. To establish something that gives the other fellow the possibility to do it himself, this is great. Or breaks up this possibility for him, opens up that way. Nothing is great that has to be claimed as something that can be done only by a certain...
We have talked in the last lecture about the spiritual situation, so to speak, the situation of man's mind today as to his productive and creative forces. The situation that prevails between the sciences, philosophy, art, religion, we have found that they have driven apart, but on the other hand, the great chance that every one of those capabilities in a way seems to have come into its own. Now here are really, in the sense, and now I must stress your point in that sense, there are real enjoyable possibilities in this situation which we mostly do not see. And here we face exactly our problems as former ages faced their problems, only that our problem seems to be harder. This spiritual situation with its dangers and possibilities. Let us to the approach first to check, to make an inventory of what the capabilities and powers of the human mind really are. And who man might be, if he is perhaps able to cope with this new situation as he was able to cope with all of them up to now. And what line he could possibly take in order to give foundation to that. We have to look first, set a framework of this mind of man, so to speak, itself, so to speak, an historical background. We have to find out what did this mind of man up to now do. Are there perhaps certain states of it that are definitely distinguishable, and in which man, by the help of his mind, because man possesses his mind, he has it, he is not mind. He must be something more than mind, because he can use mind and develop it. But such an abstract, seemingly abstract proposition as the mind of man, isn't that perhaps a monster, like society seems to be? Isn't that perhaps an entirely ungraspable thing that is merely a reflection of certain abstract notions of ours? We know there have been philosophies, especially in India, with that philosophy, and in the West, very many of them. Hegel's the last one, where, so to speak, a cosmic mind exists. In which man, and every man, just participates. He is a part of this cosmic mind, a supernaturalistic power, so to speak, a higher power, of which we are a part, which would mean that man essentially is a mind, not has a mind, which would make him unfree. Namely, he would then again function only, not according to society and its whims, but according to some higher laws of this cosmic mind itself, which only makes Sammy run, or makes man function. This mystical entity we can, of course, not accept. So we have to ask the question, in what sense do we think that we could prove that there is a reality which we could call the mind of man? That is a question much more difficult to answer. We first can observe one thing, that if we can establish any fundamental equality of men, which sometimes in free republics we could, it was either established on the belief that all men are equal before God, because they are created in the image of God. We take that as a mythical, or let's say figurative expression here in this course. For a fact, a reality, we have to formulate philosophically. The formulation would then have to be that we are able to observe through all history and in our own time by communication with other men that the structure, the fundamental capabilities of the human mind seem to be the same in everybody. And that is what makes him a man, a human being. Not that they are equal in the sense of egalitarians, in that sense that everybody has the same stature, or is equal in intellect to anybody else. Those are nonsensical exaggerations of democratism as an ideology that wants to make all people alike in order to rule finally all people. People are not alike. Everybody is different from everybody else, and everybody might be in his innermost being even unique as a human person. And we seem to lose that feeling of uniqueness just in our time, but nevertheless, as far as the creative equipment goes in quality, the equipment of the human mind we have, we are fundamentally equal. That makes us possible to say that all experiences of men are human experiences, that we can talk about human experience as a definite reality. Now, if we create a history, and history does not create itself, we have the phenomenon before us that, and for the first time in history, that since the time of the Greeks, the Hebrews and the Greeks in the West, there has been a line of continuous historical development. This merely means, if one does not want to be magical and mystical about it, that one of the cultures created by those societies was able to influence the other, that a continuous tradition has developed. This has not been the case in other states and in other developments of men. If we had lost the Egyptian experience and the Greek would not have come, we might have been split up into different experiences of states or peoples which have no connection and could not build a tradition. So this is an exceptional case of history which by no means might prevail, let alone the thinking of mystical historians like Karl Marx, mystical. because metaphysical would think that we can take it for granted that there is such a monstrous thing going on by itself as human history and will always continue and give us opportunities. We know now about prehistoric and even historic times where such a continuity could and wasn't, could not have been and was not established. The experiences got lost, that we, out of this tradition that we created in the West, are today able